All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Today we're going to go a bit backwards in our timeline, back to some of the issues that we covered in our Chapter 5 episodes. All of the research that I did on newspapers and their early attempts to experiment with digital media came from secondary sources. That's why I was super excited to be introduced to Steve Yelvington on Twitter. Steve is a several decades long veteran of the newspaper industry, as well as a true online and web pioneer. He gives us some great first-person perspective about how the news industry succeeded and failed in its attempts to address the challenges of the internet era. In our discussion, we mention a recent blog post of his in our conversation, and if you go to the show notes for this episode, you can get a link to that blog post. So enjoy this conversation with news and internet pioneer Steve Yelvington. Steve Yelvington, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
You got your start in newspapers in the 70s?
I sort of grew up in the newspaper business. My dad was a newspaper editor, so you know, I have roots going back into the dark ages of hot type, linotypes, molten lead, and that kind of thing.
What papers did he work at?
He worked at a daily newspaper in East St. Louis, Illinois, that's no longer there, like most of East St. Louis, and was editor there. So I grew up around speed graphic cameras, 4x5 film cameras, you know, the kind mm-hmm. of thing you see in old black and white movies.
Right. And when you got your start in newspapers, you started out in St. Louis as well?
I started out in college town, a daily newspaper experience. I actually edited some weeklies owned by my family for a while,
mm-hmm.
But then in Champaign, Illinois, and then moved back down to St. Louis and worked at the St. Louis Globe Democrat, another paper that's no longer with us, and then moved on to Minneapolis at the Star Tribune, and it was in Minneapolis that I moved from print to online.
Right. So obviously, with the direction your career takes, I'm curious to know, were you also a bit of a nerd, a computer guy at all?
Yeah, actually, yes. I moved to Minneapolis in about 1985 and didn't know anybody, and discovered a local computer monthly called Computer User, and in the back of it they had a list of bulletin board systems. So I bought a computer, an Atari, and a modem, and started dialing, and I discovered this incredible online world of conversation. There were about, I think, 80 or 90 bulletin boards privately run, and I wound up being lured into that and running my own BBS.
300 baud era we're talking about?
300 baud and manual dial.
Mm-hmm. putting the phone cradle in the handset in the cradle sort of thing.
Yep, and watching the characters scroll by very slowly on
mm-hmm,
screen.
Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to your personal experiences and your career in a second, but let's do talk about what your memories are about what early experimenting was already being done on things like BBSs and on things on online services in general. Do you have any memories of things like, you know, the Viewtron or any other things like that newspapers were starting to experiment with?
I knew about it. I didn't. I never had a Viewtron terminal. I know a guy who has a couple of them,
mm-hmm.
but I knew about Viewtron teletext operations. I was pretty plugged into what the newspaper industry was doing, reading trade journals, that kind of thing. And there was a lot of early experimentation with video text and so on in the 1970s and 80s. On the proprietary services that existed back there, things like CompuServe.
Mm-hmm.
I also knew that Knight Ridder newspaper chain had invested very heavily in Viewtron, and the scuttlebutt in the industry was that they lost about $60 million. And that sort of burned the fingers of a lot of people, a lot of enthusiasm about investing heavily in online. Retreated after that.
And that was, Viewtron was in the early 80s, right?
It was announced in the 70s, but it really came to life in the early 80s. They were still selling Viewtron access when I moved to Minneapolis because I saw the ads in the St. Paul paper, which they owned.
Mm-hmm. And so Viewtron was video text based, right?
Yeah, it originated before personal computers were common and inexpensive.
Well, actually, you know what? That might be useful for our listeners. If you could describe what video text and like what was this service if it wasn't PC based yet?
They started out with a little keyboard that really was a microcomputer that they sold as part of the access package. It was very limited, and it had a built-in modem. It could dial up and display only what was on that service. You couldn't use it for any other purpose. Before long, though, Radio Shack brought out the color computer, Coco, that was inexpensive enough that that people could casually afford it, and then I believe Viewtron became available on that platform. There were other services like Prodigy that were PC-based, and of course, America Online.
Well, and in Europe, they have Minitel, which is a similar sort of terminal-based system, right?
The French system, Minitel, there was, I think, CFAX and Prestel. There were a lot of these systems that were really dedicated services that you could use for kind of the closed system purpose. They weren't general purpose computers like you and I would think of them.
So I think this is an important point to underline, though. A lot of these experiments are being created by newspaper companies like Knight Ridder, and so this is a full decade before the web. They're trying to experiment with an interactive digital way of delivering their content, right?
That's exactly right, and the thing to grab a hold of there is distributing their content. They really understood everything through the lens of a traditional publisher that says, I gather, I organize, and I distribute, and you guys consume. And when the web came along, the web flipped all of that over, and from the point of view of a publisher, it was total chaos.
Well, because almost all of these experiments are subscription based, right? You're paying, you're renting the terminals, and you're paying a monthly fee for the access.
That was the economic foundation of all these was primarily consumer revenue based. Now, Prodigy had a slightly different vision. They really had access plus advertising, plus e-commerce in their business plan. But things like Minitel really started out as a cheaper way of having phone directories.
And again, these experiments are widespread. I mean, Los Angeles Times is doing it. Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Milwaukee Journal, Washington Post, I think I remember they had a service for a while, too.
Washington Post was an early mover into kind of the current era, I would describe it as. They saw that the opportunity was to use the much-improved PCs to give you an experience that, in their vision, was kind of newspaper-like. It had fonts, and you know, it was the Macintosh thing. Their first prototype was actually built on a Mac using HyperCard, just to show people what might be possible. And the vision was to create an edition, a digital edition of a news presentation.
And so it's not. Is it still just repurposing what was in the print edition, or are they even early on starting to do specific digital-only content?
It was largely repurposing. Probably the exception to that was the emergence of forums on, I recall, Access Atlanta. This is before they were even officially up and running, but they were in beta. They had forums, and the forums just took off on the Prodigy platform.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they learned, though, is that users were very, very vocal and very critical of the newspaper for being slow. They said, this is a digital medium. This should be right now. I want to know the score of the game the second it's over with. Don't make me wait for tomorrow morning when you post the story.
The trolls are there already, and they're already angry.
They were very opinionated, and it was an eye-opening experience for those of us who were sort of hovering over this.
Okay, so then that does bring us back into your personal history with this. So by the early 90s, they're experimenting with full online services, so no longer with these separate terminals, the things you can access from your PC. And around 1994, I believe Star Tribune Online, which you helped launch, is one of these efforts. Is that right?
Yes, the Star Tribune made a decision to move ahead in this territory. We looked around and saw other newspapers doing it and wanted to get out there. And the first goal was to learn. So we very, very seriously thought about going on to the Prodigy platform along with other newspapers where we thought we could exchange information. About that time, the Ziff Davis magazine people who published popular photography and a bunch of car magazines back in the day, the Ziff Davis people had been publishing for years on CompuServe and AOL, and they were very dissatisfied with the user experience. They had gone out and built a proprietary online service that used SGML and style sheets and templates and a database-backed publishing system, hired a bunch of people from Lotus down the road from them in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to build this thing, and it was a piece of work. It was gorgeous. Typography, they hired Matthew Carter to create their own fonts, and we decided to go publish on that platform and built an online service at the Star Tribune that we would sell to consumers, and it would include the rest of what was on that platform. Called Interchange, the Ziff Davis part was kind of built into the offer. And if you wanted to add the Washington Post, you could do that. Everybody was very excited about this model that was still founded on paid access. And actually, you had to pay for your dial-up time as well.
I know, I promise you wouldn't have to remember numbers, but in the ballpark, do you have any recollection of what my monthly fee would have been to use this service?
when we started working on it, most of the services were like $1 an hour of access time.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we actually launched, it had gone flat rate. I think we were charging about $12, $10 or $12 a month for the subscription. But we never got more than probably around 800 paid users before the entire world changed around us, and within 6 or 8 months we made a decision to move to the web.
So this would be about 1995 when you see the web taking off.
95, in 1995 and 96, everything changed. We in Minneapolis went from a scenario where you had really two internet service providers, the university, if you knew somebody there,
mm-hmm.
and the Minnesota Regional Network, which really dealt with tech companies, leased lines, that kind of thing. We went from those two to about 110 or 115 garage-based internet service providers. Every geek in town became an ISP in order to fund their personal internet addiction. And so there were dial-ups everywhere, flat rate. The economics of internet access just blew out in literally 8 to 10 months.
So you do transition to a website, and I guess you eventually just completely drop the dial-up service.
It took about 6 months to make that change. We had to build. People don't remember how primitive the web was back then. You can't build a really big complicated operation if everybody's sitting there writing HTML.
Right. Well, and there's not a lot of off-the-shelf open source packages like there are today.
Just nothing. So we had to build our own production system, a lot of Perl scripts and a lot of Sybase database work. And those of us who had an inclination to learn such things learned an awful lot really quickly about software development processes.
I'm curious. You're having to learn yourself. Are you able to hire in? Again, this is so early on. There's not a generation of geeks that have come up learning programming, and especially in Minneapolis. Like, how do you get the talent to get the operation off the ground?
Well, we were blessed in Minneapolis by its history as a technology environment back mm-hmm. in the days of Control Data Corporation.
Right.
And really big supercomputers. There were ETA Systems was based up there, and Apollo, and companies that are all gone now. So we were able to hire contractors who had who knew enough Perl, enough database to build a system, and really created our own publishing environment. Nobody was vending that kind of thing then.
And once your transition to a website, again, I'm assuming that early on, again, the model is to just repurpose the print content, right?
Well, I think most newspapers approached it that way. We actually did not. When we made the decision to move to the web, the plan was that we would update the website continuously. But had a lot of meetings with the newsroom. Ground rules mm-hmm. for when you wrote what, and the as I recall, the basic rule was that any story that was in the public domain, in other words, it wasn't an investigation that we exclusively held, but people knew about it. As soon as we knew the basic, the who, what, where, when, and how, we got the basics up online, and then the expectation was that it would be replaced by a longer version when the reporter got done doing a more thorough and deeper job of reporting. Most newspapers didn't do that, and really didn't grasp that that importance of continuous publishing and real time for years. You know, years later, I would see an announcement of, you know, the Washington Post has created a continuous news desk, and
right,
that's what the newsroom's for. So we got that, and I have to credit, you know, the loudmouths who were complaining on Access Atlanta, where I saw this voiced so powerfully, as being an inspiration for us. We didn't want to be viewed that way by our customers.
How about community? How about bulletin boards, maybe even online classifieds? Did you experiment with any of those?
We did. Had the benefit of, you know, the fact that I had started out playing in the bulletin board world made me look at the online experience as one founded primarily on conversation. The system that that Interchange that Ziff Davis had built actually had great forum software because they came out of that world as well. They came out of, you know, CompuServe, SIGs, that kind of thing. So from day one, we were very focused on community conversation, commenting, engagement of that type. And even before the web, we moved to the web, we were trying to get community organizations to come and publish on our platform and have their, you know, organizations, church groups, and civic organizations to have their own spaces. So we, from day one, were trying to create really kind of what the web became. But the thing about the web is I'm reminded of something I heard Scott Kernet say. Scott was, when I met him, was marketing director at Prodigy and
right.
Went on to found the mining company and so on. But at a conference, he said, okay, open systems. Beat great closed systems every time. And the web, being an okay open system, as primitive as it was, enabled everybody to come at once and do the thing, the idea they had. So there was no way that proprietary systems, regardless of whether you had Sears, CBS, IBM, and, you know, et cetera, behind them, you just could not keep up when everybody comes at you. So the web basically replaced the proprietary stuff, and just it didn't even take a year. It was the fastest change I have ever seen.
You always read about, even to this day, you know, editorial being uncomfortable with the great unwashed masses interacting amongst their content and in their product. With your immediate bosses, was there any pushback on that? Was there any debates about I don't know, like we said, trolls or comments being unruly, that sort of thing?
No, there wasn't. But you know, I was blessed to work for Tim McGuire, who now teaches at Arizona State, and Tim understood this kind of naturally. My bosses didn't get flaky about it, but I know that we had kind of an ease into this because we were subscription-based. Everyone was posting with their real name, and not just a name, but their real name, because mm-hmm. it was the name that was on their credit card.
Right.
And we were able to move into the interactive world in a kind of a sheltered environment that didn't have trolls and didn't have abusers. And it was before spam really took over the experience. So things were actually a lot easier back then. Now, when we moved to the web, we built forums using some software that in some ways looked kind of like what we were using on the Interchange platform. And there were only a few, it's called Web Crossing, and there were only a few companies using it. One of them was, I think, Salon. And Salon had a troll problem. they cracked down on their trolls and gave everybody a 1 month timeout who was abusive, said, you know, okay, you can come back after a month, but you're not going to use this for a month because your account's suspended. Well, all these people looked around for a comfortable environment that looked like the one they were used to, and they found ours. We had this, it was like an invasion of locusts from California that came in and created a great deal of uproar in about 48 hours on the Star Tribune Online's bulletin boards. What happened next just was amazing. Our users stood up and spoke up and said, y'all are, they didn't say y'all because this is Minnesota.
Right, right.
They said, you are welcome to be here. You are welcome to participate in a conversation with us, but you have to adhere to our social norms. You have to behave like a Minnesotan and be very polite and no personal attacks. And the people who'd been thrown out of Salon conformed. That peer pressure is so incredibly powerful. So, you know, we had actually very good experiences with this. Over time, though, as internet access became cheaper and easier and really, really large numbers moved into the environment, the whole commenting experience was it was undermined by fairly small numbers of people, but when you have a really large universe to pick from, there's going to be an adequate supply of idiots who will abuse and basically drive out the good conversation. And that's really been the struggle in the more modern era. It's not that I think journalists hate the masses. I think it's more that we are appalled at the results of a fairly small group of jerks who make it impossible for anybody else to have a good conversation.
I want to go more into conceptual questions like this, but one more question about the era, because this is, as we enter into the late 90s, everyone remembers it as the dot-com era, the web taking off, but it's kind of forgotten today that this was also the era of AOL's dominance, because AOL was how the vast majority of Americans at the time actually got online and found their way to a site like yours. Did you guys do any partnerships, any work with AOL or their Digital Cities initiative and things like that?
We did actually work with Digital Cities. That was kind of the year when everybody was doing everything. So AOL came to town and set up a Digital Cities operation with an office and a staff.
Mm.
But we built a relationship with them and published some of our content on the AOL platform. Somewhere I still have the hat. We competed with Microsoft. Microsoft started something called Sidewalk.
Right.
And they also opened up an office in town with a staff. So it was a great place to be if you liked competition, because you had Star Tribune online becoming StarTribune.com. You had Sidewalk. You had Digital Cities. You had the St. Paul Pioneer Press had something called Pioneer Planet. Everybody was into weird names back then, and we also were the market where Channel 4000, internet broadcasting company, began. Internet broadcasting then became a very big provider of web services to TV stations all over the country. So we were the kind of the home market for them. A knife fight for audience and for attention, and it really accelerated the development of the interactive audience in the Twin Cities.
So, okay, great. Now that we have this framework of the chronology of newspaper experiments in the 90s. Let's move to some of the, like I said, the conceptual issues. One of the ways that I was turned on to you as somebody interesting to talk to is you recently had a blog post that I'll link to in the show notes where you took exception to the idea that is fairly common out there that the original sin of for newspapers and journalism on the web was that 20 years ago, everyone just started giving away their content for free. And as we've already talked about, that's not exactly how it happened.
Yeah, we actually tried pretty hard to charge for content. The explosion of content, not news content, but just content on the internet that took place when when the access rules went away and commercial operation was possible, basically drew the attention away from traditional media. If you kind of go back and to the print era and think of what a newspaper was back then, it was a package of news, of course, but it was also the entertainment. The evening newspaper was the evening's entertainment for a lot of people. You only had one or two TV stations in most markets. So as television, as radio, and then the internet sort of exploded the options, the audience progressively looked at news as a newspaper and the package that came every day as a thinner and thinner slice of what they were going to be consuming.
So the point you're making is almost that it's just there's this explosion of options, and so one way or another, news is just one more option, one more channel out there to grab people's interest, and it was difficult to compete with the explosion of options, basically.
Absolutely, we have data now on how much time and how many page views are snapped up by different categories of use on the internet, different competitors, and social media, of course, is huge, and the use of literally news sites, whether they be newspaper or radio or TV based or completely independent, is just a very tiny slice. It's part of your sort of circle of life, but it's a smaller and smaller part. That's not a good thing. I wish people spent less time with the Kardashians and a whole lot more time with their communities. But it is the reality that we're living in, and it's one of the several big transformations that have posed huge problems for traditional news companies.
Well, let me sort of to play devil's advocate. Let me poke at this a little bit more, because going back to the late online era, early 90s, when content providers do deals with people like Prodigy and AOL, like for example, Time does a deal to put some of their magazines on AOL's service. AOL's paying them. So the content providers can justify this as, well, we're expanding our revenue stream. This is a new distribution channel, and we're getting paid for it. But from the user's perspective, then all of a sudden, having People magazine, I don't know if People was one of the titles that was on there, but that's just something that came for free along with their subscription to AOL. You know what I mean? Like, so was there an era maybe where news and content was at least devalued in the user's mindset?
I think that the value was in the value of the brand. When these traditional brands became part of the package, it was persuasive. It enabled the ISPs and the pre-ISPs services to say to the consumer, we have a huge collection of things that you will recognize and know. What happened after they got there is that the actual parts of the service that interested people was different from what the upfront offer was. So what really attracted people turned out to be the conversation.
Right.
There's a story about the technology of this. Prodigy built IBM.
IBM and Sears, right.
And CBS built their own network. And in each local market, they had a server, a caching server. And all these caching servers were hooked back to the mothership in White Plains through tiny little 56K frame relay lines. And the system was architected for pushing out broadcasting information from a creator and aggregator out to the consumer. Well, when they installed forum software, it overwhelmed their network. People stopped spending their time reading the Washington Post story or the Atlanta Journal-Constitution story. They stopped reading that kind of thing and went into reading a conversation or a live chat with other people. They had to rebuild the whole darn network to accommodate the reality of human behavior that we all like to chat. I can remember in my research when I was working on building Star Tribune Online, I ran across a story, I think it was a Los Angeles Times story, about the construction of the Knight Ridder service, Viewtron. And they had an interview with a Knight Ridder executive who was really bitter about the failure of Viewtron. And he blamed it on the users, which is, kind of crazy, but he blamed it on the users being more interested in chatting about sex than in reading news. And I read that, and I thought only a newspaper executive would find it surprising that people found sex more interesting than news.
Mm-hmm. It was ever thus, I guess.
The things that people actually use the internet for, have to do with basic human needs, and a lot of that is communication. The things that attracted them to the service, to get back to your point, I think that the existence of these traditional respected brands did an awful lot to help those services get up and running.
Well, also, to come at it in a different way, by the time of the portals, so we're in the web era now, and places like Yahoo and Excite become these portals, like Yahoo does this great deal with Reuters to provide headlines and news, and so again, my question is like from a user's experience, I come to the web. The web is essentially free. There's a few things that ask me to pay, but I tend to avoid those. And when I go to Yahoo every morning, I expect all these freebies, like to check mail, to see the sports scores, to see the weather. And so then the news is just another part of these table stakes that I expect to be there for my online experience.
It's a valuable part of the mix. People would check the headlines, not so much to see what had happened, but to make sure that nothing bad had happened that they might need to know about, and then move on to something else. Excite told us that about 40% of their total usage drove to local resources. This is at the time at which I worked for Cox Interactive in Atlanta, building a network of a national network of local portals, local sites. There was a great deal of interest in practical information about my neighborhood. So you might have come for the headlines and checked them, and then you move on to the other stuff. And the greatest difficulty newspaper and traditional media companies have had is understanding that it's the other stuff that they really need to be focusing on. Not that you don't focus on news, but you really need to be useful and interactive and entertaining and engaging.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So another thing that's out there in our popular imagination about what has happened to newspapers and content on the web is that you know, the web comes along and it kills this golden goose of classified ads that it turns out was the thing that was, again, the golden goose for the news industry for all this time. But if you look at the numbers, it's not until even the middle of the last decade that you start to really see classified advertising really crashing. So it wasn't immediately things like eBay came in and killed newspaper classifieds. You know, Craigslist doesn't really take off till the mid-2000s nationwide. So I'm curious, is this another myth that as soon as the web was there, classifieds were dead for newspapers?
Well, I think that as soon as the web was there and a couple of early examples of classifieds showed up, there were those of us in the newspaper industry who could read the writing on the wall that this great revenue source that we had wasn't necessarily going to continue. We tried what we could. In fact, newspaper companies got together and invested in a competitor to eBay that failed.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of those. I mean, Career Builder was a newspaper consortium. Mm-hmm. Cars.com, I believe, also was. And even early on, what was the New Century Network?
Well, the New Century Network actually dates right back to the beginning of the web transition for newspapers.
Uh-huh.
And news companies looked at the web and they said, okay, scale is important. We're not quite sure what that means, but scale is important. And people coming online are going to want to have one payment that gives them the stuff they need. And so companies like Knight Ridder, which had moved into the ISP business, and Landmark, companies like that were ISPs, and they thought that you could extend this content access model, the paid circulation model, to the whole world. So what they tried to first envision, and this went away before it even got off the ground, what they thought about doing was kind of a library card system. You pay one price for internet access from your local newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the internet and you get access to all of the participating newspapers' content. And they're going to track that and ship money back and forth, you know, recognition of value created, that kind of thing. Really a complicated thing to do. People who didn't subscribe to any of the newspapers wouldn't be able to get any of the newspapers. They got as far as, you know, drawing up the request for proposals and circulating that in the industry, but it's hard to get newspaper companies to cooperate with one another because they're all very competitive and should be. So the the effort fell apart, and what did survive was the construction of some national advertising networks, national advertising sales initiatives, and some content exchanges. And toward the end, there were conversations about buying Netscape.com, mm-hmm. which had a lot of traffic, and using it as a portal to drive traffic to news sites. The kind of the underappreciated part of the problem back then was finding stuff on the internet. This is before
Google.
Before Google rewrote the world. Alta Vista was an eye opener for a lot of us. I think Alta Vista, actually, there were newspaper investors in that. The company I work for now invested heavily in Zip2, which was one of Elon Musk's early projects, and made a ton of money on that deal when Zip2 was sold to Compaq. So we were all trying to figure out a business model. Every conference I went to had these long, insufferable conversations about the need to develop a business model, but really nothing was clear, and our reflexes kept driving us toward this notion of charging individuals for access, and the individuals, people, customers' point of view was what you said earlier. You know, I already paid. I paid my ISP. Why do you want me to pay?
Right.
You know, I want this as simple as possible.
So if there's one thing I feel like I want to underline here, it's that this notion that the newspapers had their heads in the sand and didn't see this coming is completely false. They saw it coming. They tried several different kinds of efforts, some related to classified, some related to subscriptions and ISPs and things like that. And it's just that none of them actually took hold.
I think it's true, but it's the opposite is also true. There were plenty of people who had their heads in the sand. There were basically people in newsrooms were willfully ignorant of the business realities of their own business. And many of them developed very strong opinions without bothering to do any research. And hence my blog post, whatever your opinion is fine, but please do your reporting first and base your opinion on facts. There were a lot of people in the industry who wanted all this to go away. And there were people who made sort of ego-driven pronouncements about how content was important and people ought to pay for it, therefore we're going to charge. There was denial. There were companies that chose to invest in buying more of the past instead of investing in the future. They bought newspaper, and they leveraged the companies to do it. They borrowed millions, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and then couldn't pay the loans. That's why you saw the bankruptcies, the collapse of newspaper companies that you've seen in the last decade. It wasn't so much because the internet had destroyed newspapering. The internet gave newspapering a lot of problems, but it was because these companies had just over leveraged themselves not to invest in digital efforts, but rather to invest in new presses, bigger presses, more newspapers, and more of the past.
To that end, kind of, how do you feel personally about paywalls as a business model today? Can they work? And if they can work, in what ways can they work, and what allows them to work?
Well, they can work. They can't work very well. They do work. We have the pay meter approach, which has emerged in the last 5 or 6 years, says, first of all, we need to let people see what we're doing. They won't give us any money at all if they don't know what we're doing. So you let people sample. And then if they're heavy users, you ask them to pay, and a percentage of them will. So, yeah, we're able to get some revenue, not nearly as much as I'd like, and I think ultimately not as much as we need to go forward with the kind of quality that we produce today. We have to develop other revenue sources. So the revenue sources are consumer revenue from subscriptions and the continued existence of print, which it may drop in penetration and frequency, but it's not going away. Mm-hmm. And it is profitable. It's just not as big as it used to be. And then we have moved very aggressively into the sales of digital services. Most newspapers, and ours is one of them, sells ad retargeting. So, a business that is based here can have ads that chase consumers all over the internet, showing up on weather.com or whatever, based on their behavior and their interest profiles. It's not just, our website. It's a broad array of SEO and search engine marketing and all that kind of thing.
So it's about finding the right mix of all sorts of different kinds of products, and paywalls can be a component of that. Free content can be a component of that, and even print can still be a component of that.
Pretty much. There's no silver bullet. There's just a whole bunch of BBs.
I'm curious what you think of what people call these new digital native companies. I'm thinking of companies like BuzzFeed and Vox Media, who are almost entirely free, don't have any paywalls and stuff, but they also have zero background in any sort of print legacy or anything like that. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this new breed of company.
Well, a lot of them have two things that traditional newspaper media doesn't have. Newspapers in this country are fundamentally local, geographically local businesses, and operate on a constrained scale, a geographically constrained scale because of that. A Vox, or I mean, look at what Nick Denton has done with his website. Mm-hmm. They go global. They don't have to go very deep, but they go really wide in terms of who they engage with. So that enables them to fairly inexpensively create a whole lot of advertising inventory. The second thing they do is that they operate as on a pretty thin expense line. They don't have the legacy costs that we would have. So they're able to do that and survive and be profitable, even though we all know that national and international ad rates are a commodity. Commodities, the nature of commodities is that price will be driven down to the cost of production. So they have to be operating in a very thin line between what they can sell for and what it costs them to make that inventory. So yeah, they come out making money. Now, do they contribute to society? Not necessarily. Some do, and I think Vox is on that list. They're not always great reporting engines, but they may, Vox is a great explanatory engine.
Well, and places like Vice would say, and even BuzzFeed, Jonah Peretti it says all the time that they're expanding into original reporting. But then again, there's a huge difference between sending one guy to Africa to cover Ebola versus having an entire African bureau staffed by, 30, 40 people that are regularly collecting stories.
Having people there all the time.
Exactly.
You can do that kind of reporting by chasing stories after they surface. But the great job that good journalism does is making stories surface that don't want to be surfaced. The thing that I respect most about great reporting is the discovery. Great storytelling. I love great storytelling. It's wonderful when it happens, but the real wonder to me happens when reporters dig deep and find out things that people don't want known. So my opinion of the BuzzFeeds of this world will go up when they do exactly that, and they can, but they don't necessarily.
Well, let's hope they're moving in that direction. One more question. Just comment on our current social world, the infrastructure of these big content silos, almost like Facebook, like Twitter, like Google to an extent. I'm thinking obviously most recently about the brouhaha about Facebook Instant articles and this notion that now there's this new problem for content and news creators that they're no longer in control of their own audience. Even it's all, they're beholden to Facebook and they're beholden to getting likes and tweets and things like that.
Facebook is the best friend to the news industry right now, and also its worst enemy. It's really in passing search as a source of traffic. So those of us who really, really need to build engagement on the sites that we've built really like Facebook for that. But at the same time, we're painfully aware that they have taken away the key function that we want to play, and that is to be the primary provider and connector. The conversation on Facebook is so powerful that people spend incredible amounts of time there and get their basic understanding of the news in our communities from that stream. We have to be there. It's not an option. We have to be there. But the time and attention is accruing to Facebook and not to the people who are doing the digging and the discovery and the creation of news. We can all see this. You look at the number of people who see a post on Facebook, the number of people who click, the number of people who comment, and then the number of people who actually go all the way through to the article and read the article. It's pretty depressing. People are more interested in looking at the headline, having an instant opinion, and discussing it with their friends than they are at reading the traditional journalism. Now, what that means is, in order to teach people what we have learned, we have to learn to converse more effectively than we're doing now. And doing that on our site or on their site, sometimes that gets disconnected from the business model. So that's the real challenge that we have.
Okay, I lied. One more question. I'm at least professionally friendly with journalists that came up as bloggers, you know, the Ezra Klein's, Matt Iglesias's of the world. And they would tell you, if you ask them, that there's never been a better time to be a writer. There's so many new channels and opportunities out there. When you speak to, because I assume you must on occasion, speak to, let's say, young people coming out of journalism school, what do you say to them? Are you optimistic about their future?
Well, I understand the point of view that says there's never a better time to do what I'm doing right now. You can say that if you are having success and feeding yourself. If you're coming out of journalism school and looking at the industry as a place that you are going to have a comfortable career and know where your paycheck is coming from, that's a different challenge. It is, it's a frightening and tough thing for a J school graduate today to look at a career and have any kind of confidence that it's going to go well. But, you know, if it is going well, I can't imagine how you could not be just overwhelmingly excited about all the things that are happening, all the things you can do, the kind of engagement you can have with people, the ability to reach a global audience if you just tell the story right. Those are really exciting aspects.
Well, let's finish by asking you what you're doing today and what you're doing with the Savannah Morning News.
What I'm doing today is I've moved through the sort of corporate overhead experience and decided that I wanted to come to one of the operating units and be here in Savannah, which is a wonderful town. And my responsibility is I'm called the Vice President of Audience, and it really is a job that recognizes our business is built around putting an audience together and then selling its attention to advertisers. So we have a VP of revenue and a VP of audience. So I'm responsible for that part of the entire enterprise that serves consumers. That's the news department. It's also commercial content. It's circulation and delivery. And pulling all of that together under one team. So I've kind of returned to the world where print is a big part of what I worry about. I'm not purely digital anymore after having done that for quite a long time.
Well, Steve Yelvington, I thank you so much for giving us the context and the chronology of newspapers and the challenges of the web era.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope I got some of this right.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.